Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. At Beth Emmanuel, we teach Messianic Judaism for all nations. If you find these teachings helpful, please share them with your friends and family. Help us advance the teachings of the kingdom, and remember to support Beth Emmanuel with your prayers and financial gifts.
Shalom, this is Aaron Eby. This is a re-recording of a message that I originally delivered on Shabbat, October 19th, 2013. At Beth Emmanuel Sabbath Fellowship while I was filling in for Daniel Lancaster. Today we read Parashat Vayera. In this parasha, we're introduced to the character of Isaac. One thing we notice about Isaac is that very little stands out about him. He's a very passive character. Our parasha includes the story of the binding of Isaac on the altar. The binding of Isaac is called in Hebrew the Akedah, and it's in Genesis 22. So listen to this account of Abraham's interaction with Isaac on the way to Mount Moriah. This is from Genesis 22, starting in verse 6. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them, together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." He said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So they went, both of them, together. Now, Daniel often cites his brother Stephen Lancaster's observation on this passage. It's bookended by the phrase, "they went, both of them, together." In Hebrew, it's "vayelchu shnehem yachdav," and it's exactly the same in verse 6 and in verse 8. Steve explains that it's as if the narrative shifts gears at this point and zooms into the real-time conversation between Abraham and Isaac. And that's the purpose of the repetition of the phrase, "they went, both of them, together." But what an interesting phrase to repeat. What is it? Why was it this particular phrase that the Torah chose to repeat? What's so special about the phrase, "they went, both of them, together"? Now that we're looking at Abraham and Isaac side by side, it's interesting to compare the two of them. And when we compare them, the result is interesting and even a little paradoxical. On the one hand, Abraham and Isaac are perfectly identical. Whatever Abraham does, Isaac seems also to do. Abraham digs wells and gives them names. Isaac digs those same wells and gives them the same names. Abraham goes to Gerar and tells Abimelech, "She is my sister." Isaac goes to Gerar and tells Abimelech, "She is my sister." Midrash Tanhuma notes the similarity between Abraham and Isaac. Parashat Toldot begins in Genesis 25:19 with the words, "These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac." Do you sense the redundancy in that verse? Why did the Torah have to tell us that Abraham fathered Isaac if it already said that Isaac was Abraham's son? Well, the Midrash explains it like this. When the surrounding people saw that Sarah had conceived and was now pregnant, they reasoned that Sarah had been impregnated by either Pharaoh or Abimelech. Well, it broke Abraham's heart to hear people say that, but you know what? It was a perfectly logical thing to believe. So what did God do? He formed Isaac in the exact likeness of Abraham so that everyone would plainly see that he was truly Abraham's son. Their facial features were identical. Now, as Daniel would point out, if you were giving this lesson, if you're wondering whether or not to take this midrash as literally true and historical, you're asking the wrong question. That's not the point. Nonetheless, I do like to take this midrash seriously because it highlights the pattern of scandalous birth in the scriptures. Likewise, scoffers believed our master to be illegitimately conceived, but he too was identical to his father. But I digress. The point of this midrash is to highlight the similarity between Isaac and his father Abraham. And yet, Abraham and Isaac were also exact opposites. The fact that Isaac walked in the footsteps of his father, ironically, is precisely what makes him so different from his father. Well, let me explain by looking once more at the story of the Akedah. The Torah introduces this story with the words, "After these things God tested Abraham." But who really had the greater test? Was it Abraham or was it Isaac? According to Jewish tradition, based on the age of Sarah when she died, Isaac was 37 years old when he was bound on the altar. In my opinion, this is very close to the age our master Yeshua was when he was killed. But this suggests that Isaac was not naive, he was not ignorant, and he could not be compelled by force. So whose test was greater, Abraham's or Isaac's? Perhaps most young people would say, well, obviously it was harder for Isaac, who actually had to lay down his own life. Those of you who are parents, however, might see it otherwise. People lay down their lives all the time for various causes, but many parents would be willing to sacrifice their own lives for the sake of their children. It would be much harder for such a parent to slay their own child than to allow themselves to be killed. So from that perspective, the test for Abraham was greater. But there's a twist. Abraham's command to sacrifice his own son came from the direct voice of God. It was a divine revelation. It was a supernatural encounter. There was no room for doubt in Abraham's mind about what he should do because God was literally speaking with him. So Abraham did not worry. As the author of Hebrews states, Abraham reasoned that God was able to raise Isaac from the dead. Then the author of Hebrews cites the Midrash, which states that Isaac actually was resurrected from the dead. But what about Isaac? Isaac was not the recipient of an overt spiritual message, or a supernatural message even. Instead, Isaac learned of this plan only from his father. In order to go along with this plan, Isaac had to trust that Abraham was telling the truth, that he had heard the voice of God. He had to feel confident in Abraham's sanity, that this was not just a hallucination or some form of dementia setting in at such a late age in his life. He had to trust that Abraham had the ability to discern the difference between the voice of God and the white noise in his head. Furthermore, he had to accept that Abraham had interpreted this divine message correctly. Hey, Dad, maybe he just meant that you have to, you know, like, let me go, give me some space, some independence, or something like that, you know? He had to trust that this was not a game of telephone where the message is lost due to a poor connection. So, in this way, the test of the Akedah was far, far greater for Isaac than it was for Abraham. The Isaac's confidence and compliance with his father in such an extreme circumstance is a testimony not only of Abraham's faith in Hashem and his devotion to God, but even more so to his parenting skills. There's a difference between the faith of Abraham and the faith of Isaac. So when a person from the nations converts to Judaism and becomes a Jew legally through a Jewish court, they receive a new name. Or they receive a new Hebrew first name, for example. Perhaps they were called George before, but now they're Menashe or David or Yehuda, right? But following that first name, they are called Ben Avraham Avinu, that is, son of our father Abraham. But why are they called sons of Abraham when legally they're considered sons of Israel? You know, Ishmael was a son of Abraham. Esau was a descendant of Abraham. So part of the reason is that in naming a convert Ben Avraham Avinu, we express that that person has exhibited the faith of Abraham. The faith of Abraham is the faith that responds to the call of go from your land and from your birthplace and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. It's the faith that is required to abandon your family and your heritage, to abandon your ancestral beliefs and practices. If that's the faith that smashes your father's idols and seeks to know the one true God despite the vanity and lies you have inherited. But what about a person who's raised in a godly environment? That this person has no need to convert to anything. He should not abandon his father's home or his father's religious devotion and faith. Instead, he should embrace them and cherish them and adopt them as his own. I mean, this person is to tread the path that his father's shoes made and follow in his footsteps. In some cases, this person's task is to build upon his godly inheritance and take the path even further than his parents were willing or able to go. This person is not a son of Abraham, but a son of Isaac. Isaac not only followed his father's lead, he clung to his father's lifestyle and faith and voice and devotion to the point of being willing to lay down his very life. A year ago, last Shavuot, I gave a presentation at the First Fruits of Zion conference entitled Generation to Generation, which dealt with the difficulty of the transition between one generation of Messianic Judaism and the next. By and large, our generation is filled with sons of Abraham, people who in some sense or another let go of their beginnings to pursue a relationship with the one true God through Messianic Judaism. But sons of Abraham will run into trouble if our children are also sons of Abraham. You know, because instead of building on the godly foundation we set, they too will go from their country and from their birthplace and from their father's house, abandoning Messianic Judaism, God forbid. So how can we pass on our love for God, our devotion to Yeshua, our obedience to Torah, and our commitment to this way of life without passing along our cynical attitudes or our rejection of authority or our wanderlust? I'm not just speaking of those of us who are or will be parents. I mean, this applies to everyone, to teachers, mentors, and any of us who interact with and make an impact on the lives of young people. I mean, this week my grandfather turned 80 years old, and we went to a party, and everyone was there, my grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews, longtime family friends. And there was lots of food. There were chips, crackers, meat, vegetables, pie, cake, ice cream, so on. And I'm very blessed because my family is very, very respectful about our dietary choices. But they do not keep kosher by any means. And at the end of the night, my aunt asked me, "How do you communicate to your children what they can and can't have to eat?" I said, "Well, we just point out the things that are okay and tell them this is kosher, this is not." And she responded, "No, what I'm asking is, they never seem to cry or be upset or disappointed about not being able to have something. How do you teach them to accept the fact that they can't have something they want?" Now, at this point, I don't feel fully qualified to offer parenting advice. Maybe when my kids are grown or when I have godly grandchildren, I'll feel qualified. But so far, things are looking good. Maybe I can share at least a little. I had another story that brought me nachas this week. Also, I went to the parent-teacher conferences, and I have a fourth grader, and when they have snacks in school, she is able to examine the packaging and decide for herself whether or not it's kosher. And her teacher thought that was quite remarkable. He said that it was not normal for a 9-year-old to have that kind of control to be able to make those decisions themselves. So it was a good Kiddush Hashem. It reflected very well on my child. But how do you get children to be like that, to walk in your ways, to care like that, and to be able to control their own appetites and desires? Well, when my aunt asked me this question, I gave her a few answers, but I continued to ponder it. It made me think about Abraham and Isaac and their interchange when the two of them walked on together. Well, the very first thing that we see from the Akedah is that Isaac trusted Abraham. I mean, notice that when Isaac spoke to his father, he didn't say, "Hey, Dad, you forgot to bring an animal to sacrifice." And instead, he asked a question that implied that he assumed his father knew exactly what he was doing. "Where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Right? And when Abraham offers the simple response, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering," Isaac's silent, compliant reaction demonstrates the depth of trust in his father. And so the two of them walked on together. So how do we teach our children to trust us? On a basic level, the answer to this should be obvious. Be trustworthy. Fulfill every word that comes out of your mouth. Tell the truth, not only to your children, but to everyone. Deal honestly with others. Accept correction and questions and criticism, and change your mind once in a while if you're wrong. Don't ever make commitments that you cannot fulfill. You know, like Abraham, say little and do much. You know, let me bring a piece of bread, and here out comes the fattened calf, right? Especially toward your children, you know, and then they will grow to learn that they can count on you and they can trust you. And when you don't know the answer to a question, admit it. Even to children, you don't need to maintain this illusion of omniscience in front of your children, because ultimately, they will discover your limits, and beyond after that, at some point, they will eventually come to appreciate your life experience. Admitting your lack of knowledge only makes you more credible when you do give answers, because it demonstrates that you have a filter guiding what you say or don't say, that you are not invested in your ego, and that you have a firm grasp on reality. Beyond this, the most important way to cultivate trust in the children in your charge is to practice what you preach. Your children will learn your values by your actions, not your words. When your actions do not match your words, what they will deduce is that you don't mean what you say. And saying it more adamantly will not help. It only makes the disconnection between your words and deeds that much stronger. Hypocrisy is what we're talking about here, and hypocrisy erodes trust. It's one of the foremost faults that Yeshua found with his generation. People should be able to trust their leaders, but if their leaders say and do not do, what then? Furthermore, we must not only practice what we preach, but we must do so with enthusiasm. I mean, the verbs describing Abraham's activities clearly express this enthusiasm. Vayashkem ba'boker, he rose early in the morning, saddling his own donkey. Vayakom, vayelech, he got up and went. Abraham exemplified zrizut. That's the Hebrew term which could be translated alacrity. Abraham exuded confidence as he engaged in obedience, and that confidence rubbed off on his son. I mean, I asked my daughter the same question my aunt asked me. Why don't you ever ask me for non-kosher food? Or why don't you complain when you can't have the food somewhere? And her first response was because I already know that you'll say no. I mean, that's because we never, ever have non-kosher food. I mean, if we served non-kosher food 0.01% of the time instead of 0.00, then every meal would be a fight. My children have learned that we confidently and consistently eat kosher. Well, Abraham instilled trust in his son. A second attribute that Abraham instilled in Isaac was a sense of identity. Well, this was no small feat for Abraham, because Abraham did not have a community. He didn't have Beth Emmanuel, or he didn't have a Jewish community to be a part of. He had to manufacture a kosher environment for his family all by himself. His home was the Jewish day school, the kosher restaurant, the synagogue. But somehow, despite that challenge, Isaac gained a sense of identity. Isaac knew that he was different. He was not allowed to leave the borders of the land of Israel because of who he was. I mean, furthermore, he couldn't marry a Canaanite girl, which meant that Abraham had to go and take special care of providing a wife for him. I mean, in fact, it ultimately required miraculous angelic intervention to even be successful. But now, why couldn't Isaac marry a Canaanite? I mean, is it because Canaanites were lesser human beings? Were they incapable of learning godliness? I mean, was there something wrong with their DNA? Or is Abraham a racist? No, Isaac had a different identity, a different life path. It was part of his calling and his mission in life. Isaac could not marry a Canaanite because they're not for him. They're just not in the same category as him. It's just not a value judgment. They simply do not share in who he is, his unique identity. They have a different identity, like apples are different from oranges. I told my aunt that we teach our children that non-kosher food is just not for them. It's somebody else's food. My kids know that non-kosher food is tasty and often healthy, but they have no desire for it because it does not match who they are. It's the same with non-Jewish holidays like Christmas or Halloween. My kids don't want a Christmas tree. I mean, they can look at a Christmas tree through a window or from a distance and say, oh, that's pretty. But they don't covet one because they know that it's not compatible with who they are. They have their own holidays. They have their own decorations and practices. They don't want to go trick-or-treating because that's not their holiday either. In order to affirm Isaac's unique identity, Abraham could not compromise even one bit. It was his job to provide, then, a bride for Isaac. Abraham could not simply say to Isaac, you're different, now go find a wife for yourself. I mean, what that says to me is that if we tell our children, don't be like the world, then we have to expend the effort in giving them what they need to live an exceptional life. My children know that I always provide that for them kosher food. And as they get older and more independent, it's sometimes going to be a challenge to do it 100.00% of the time, right? If they go on a class trip somewhere, it's going to be up to me to figure out how they're going to eat kosher because I'm the one instilling their identity. But they know that they will not go hungry and that the food I provide will be tasty and nutritious. Now, you might be saying, that's all fine for you because your kids are Jewish. You know, they have a clearly defined identity. You know, and I'd agree that this finding this clear sense of identity is more of a challenge for Messianic Gentiles than it is for Jews. But the same concept applies. You know, a Messianic Gentile is not just a Gentile. Maybe you heard of Noahides, sons of Noah, B'nai Noach. Well, a Messianic Gentile, a non-Jewish disciple of Yeshua, is not merely a Noahide. non-Jewish disciples of Yeshua may not be bound to all the commandments that Jews are. But on the other hand, if you are a disciple of Yeshua, you are obligated beyond the seven laws of Noah. You are equivalent at least to the status of a ger toshav, a non-Jew who lives among Jews in Israel. And that, and thus you are responsible for those additional obligations. I mean, for more details, I'd recommend that you consult Mr. Lancaster's teachings on that. But I'm not going to get into it right now what those are. Regardless, furthermore, you are held to the surpassing ethical standard demanded by our Master Yeshua as citizens of his kingdom. So to your children you must communicate, you are not like others. How fortunate are you? How good is your portion? How glorious is the lot you are given? Your heritage is so great as a disciple of Yeshua. In the surrounding culture, people often have this crazy idea that children should be given a blank slate for an identity by their parents so that they can then go on a quest to find themselves and find out who they are. This is so completely wrong. Children are programmed from the day they're born to examine their surroundings and determine who they are, who their peers are, what is their station in life, who their authorities are, what their frame of reference is, what their identity is, what category they belong in. It's your job as parents to tell them, this is who you are. This is what you do. Here are some people like you. You know, here, as for a quest, now that you know who you are, go and find out how you're going to contribute to the world in a unique way. You know, this concept of identity is something that I see in the words. The two of them, both of them walked together, you know, Abraham and Isaac in a shared identity. And the third and final concept that I see in these words is that of ownership. Abraham passed the mantle on to Isaac. Isaac was not merely an observer of his father's religion, but he was an active participant. I mean, this can be seen clearly in the Akedah. And Abraham, it says in Genesis 22:6, and Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them, together. It doesn't say that Abraham carried the wood and the fire and the knife, and Isaac followed behind. No, they walked together. So when I talk to my kids about keeping kosher, I don't say, don't eat this because I said so. I mean, I told my aunt that if you ask my children why they can't eat bacon, the answer will not be, well, because my mom and dad won't let me. It'll be because it's not kosher. And if pressed, they will explain, well, bacon comes from pigs, and pigs are not kosher because they do not bear the signs of a kosher animal or something like that. They would be able to explain that to you. So we teach our children the laws of kashrut and the certifying symbols that help us determine what is kosher and what is not. And when they ask if they can have something at the grocery store, often our answer is, well, is it kosher? Is there a heksher on it? And then they have the burden themselves of determining if that item is kosher or not. And when they look at it and find it doesn't have a kosher symbol, then it's they themselves who determined that it's not kosher, they're much more willing to follow that decision. And as a result of being invested with the power to make these determinations, they feel ownership over them, and they're more likely to practice them. They also get the concept. These laws don't come from mom and dad. They come from God, who commands us all the same. So the two of them, Abraham and Isaac, walked together side by side to carry out their faith. And as Genesis 25:5 states, Abraham gave all he had to Isaac. He literally invested him with ownership. So we've looked at Abraham and Isaac. Abraham, the trailblazer, left his heritage behind to chase after something greater. Isaac mimicked his father like a reflection in a mirror. Abraham passed on his values to his son without passing on his desire to blaze new trails. I believe he did that by instilling in his son a sense of trust, clear identity, power of ownership. May we all, moms, dads, grandparents, mentors, teachers, whether with an official title or not, with children of our own or not, live up to the example of Abraham in raising up a new generation of godly children, children of Isaac, to whom we pass along the torch of love of God, devotion to Yeshua, obedience to the Torah, and commitment to the people of Israel and the kingdom of God.